Welcome back to Beat Seeker. I'm your host, Matt McButter. In each episode, we explore the shifting world of music with world-renowned experts and artists to take you deep, deep inside the fascinating and changing world of music technology and music discovery.
And I'm your host, Mike Weider, reminding you to subscribe in Apple Podcasts and give us a five-star rating if you like the episode. You can visit our website at beatseeker.fm, where you'll find plenty of rabbit holes with extra content to dive into, guest backgrounds, and even a playlist with music recommendations from each of our guest episodes. Also, BeatSeeker swag. You can stay current and talk to us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at BeatSeekerPod. Classical music is making a comeback in a big way. More people, including young people, are enjoying music that is written hundreds of years ago. The recent tech developments like streaming, social media, have something to do with the reawakening of this age-old genre?
Here to help us understand the classical revival is Jess Gillum. Jess is the first ever saxophonist to be signed to Decca Classics, and her debut album, Rise, shot to number one in the official UK classical charts. She became the youngest ever presenter for BBC Radio 3 and hosts her own weekly show called This Classical Life, in which she talks to her musical friends and colleagues about the music that inspires them. She joins us from just outside of London, UK. Jess, thanks for joining us on Beat Seeker.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Jess, classical music seems to be having its millennial moment. According to a recent report, classical streaming by people aged 18 to 25 has increased sharply and now accounts for over a third of all listeners. You're a classical musician yourself and also a host of a BBC show called The Classical Life, which helps expose new classical to audiences both old and new. So we want to talk to you today about why what's old is new again. But before we get into that, maybe let's start with you. Tell us how you got into classical music. Where did it start for you?
So I play the saxophone, which is not necessarily an instrument that's immediately associated with classical music. So I actually started in a carnival band in Cumbria in England, and didn't really have anything to do with classical music at all. I wouldn't have been able to really tell you any composers or even particularly known anything about classical saxophone, especially, but loved music. And then when I was about 11, started to discover classical music through seeing a live concert and then started to listen to CDs. And yeah, it began there really. But it was definitely through the instrument that I discovered it.
Beautiful, beautiful. And so tell us about This Classical Life. How did you come about hosting the show?
So there's a competition in the UK called BBC Musician of the Year, and I was a part of that. And I think they'd seen that I liked talking, basically, and they asked me if I wanted to host a podcast. And I made a podcast for them called, I think it was just called BBC Musician, and we spoke to many different musicians about different aspects of life as a musician. So we had episodes on nerves and performance anxiety, to what you wear on stage, to programming a concert, and all the different aspects of being a young musician. And then on from there, they said, would you like to host one about music? And we worked on a concept together, and that's how it was born.
Very cool. Very cool. And so on the show, I listened to a couple episodes, and I saw you basically, it seems like you sit down with a guest and explore classical music. Is that sort of that's the gist of it. But I was really curious about how you pick your guests. I mean, some are very obvious, like, you know, classical musicians or composers, but others are not so obvious. I mean, for example, I listened to one with a folk musician, Sam Amidon.
Yes.
And yeah. How do you get your guests, and what's the idea for the big breadth of types of guests that you get?
So it's interesting because the name of the show is almost misleading because the idea is that I sit with a guest each week and they bring four of their favorite pieces or songs that they're listening to at that time, and they're generally linked to classical music in some way, or they like classical music, but they really have free rein on what they choose. So they can choose anything from U2 or AC/DC or Beyonce to Beethoven or Mozart or Caroline Shaw. And so we try and reflect that in the guests as well, people who love classical music and can try and help unlock it for other people, but also love other kinds of music as well, because I think we'll probably end up talking about it in this podcast, the idea of classical music being a kind of isolated art form and its own thing isn't necessarily how it operates now, as with everything, because things have been, some might say, democratized, but things are more easily accessible online now that we can listen to any kind of music. So on the show, the kind of range of guests reflects the range of music that we play on it as well.
Yeah, it's really fun. I also listened to a bunch of episodes and added a bunch to my playlist. I on the website, it's quite convenient. You can click on the songs that you've recommended and then load them up in Spotify and then add them to your playlist. So it's helpful because I like classical music, but I struggle with discovery, which is what do I listen to? And I like the format that you've gone through. And, you know, I grew up in a family where, you know, my parents listen to classical music, but I'm sure a lot have not. But I'm wondering, like, you know, we had access to that growing up through their record or CD collection, but Spotify has really changed things in the sense that now everybody has access to basically every classical or other type of music ever made. And on one hand, I'm wondering, you know, if it's helping or hurting the consumption and this trend we're seeing and the upturn in growth, in that, you know, I guess you have access to an infinite amount of music, and that's great. But these systems also tend to operate as kind of quasi echo chambers, where this algorithm is kind of pointing you to what's popular or what you've already listened to, and often not conducive to breaking people out of a circle of music that they're in. You know, what's your take on the modern, I guess, streaming platforms in terms of their ability to help people discover classical music?
I think it's really interesting because, as you say, it's so easy to stick in your familiar 10 albums, not even albums, it can be songs or 10 playlists, because there is so much music available online that it's almost overwhelming. So for me to discover new things, I still have lots of CDs, I still have records, and actually going into a record shop and looking through the collection, even if you don't listen to it on vinyl, seeing, oh, there's 10 records by that band, I've never heard of them, I'll go and listen to that. I think the marriage between digital and physical can exist. I think they can coexist. And I think it's really important that we don't lose the ritual of physical albums and music. And I have a really interesting conversation with a friend the other day, and he's doing a thing where he has to buy at least 12 albums a year. And in order to use Spotify, he'll buy the album and then listen, so that he's not just staying in this phase. Because, yeah, you get that. It's about the time of year, as we're speaking now, that you'll get the Spotify Wrapped and see what you've been listening to the most.
Right.
And yeah. And this idea that people love the stats as well of what they're listening to. I think it can be a really interesting space to discover new things, but you're also being fed something by somebody else. So
yeah. Well, I listen to now just enough classical that I would say on my Discover Weekly, like, I guess they give you 30 songs every week, and I'm getting at least one will be a classical music song. So, and invariably I'll add that to my playlist, but that's sort of one. You know, another topic that we've covered on this podcast is that streaming has really orientated people to listen to individual tracks versus albums. Whereas with the record player, I would put on my record player and it's, you know, I'd listen to the whole thing or at least the side. Whereas with streaming, we tend to have everything on shuffle all the time. What are your thoughts about that in terms of classical music consumption, in that, you know, it's really taking, I guess, it out of how the composer or someone would have arranged a sort of set of music or a set of tracks to be listened to if I'm always shuffling through everything?
I think it presents an interesting dilemma for performers and an opportunity for recording artists to change how they view the classical album, because it might not be that a whole symphony is recorded and somebody now chooses to sit down and listen to that. And there are many recordings available if you would like to do that. But now I think as classical musicians, we can look at the album as an opportunity for creating something. So Vikingur Olafsson, the pianist, comes to mind. He sees that album as an individual craft, and it might not be identical to the show that he plays and the concert that he plays, but the studio becomes an instrument and you interact with it, and that really is a part of the process, like the Beatles did, you know, revolutionary. They used this, the studio, as a member of the band. And I think that in a way we have to accept that the way that people listen is changing, and it is probably going to stay because it's been a revolution.
It's too convenient.
Yeah, exactly. So we have to look at how we can make that artful, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Another trend we wanted to talk about a little bit is this sort of, you know, let's call it the streaming effect or Netflix effect. You know, one of the, I guess, things that has been credited with this growing classical consumption amongst younger people is Netflix and other streaming services. Bridgerton was one, example cited. Really popular show. If people don't know it, it's sort of a period, period drama, a bit of a soap opera. But it features instrumental covers of pop songs by the likes of Ariana Grande, Taylor Swift, and others. And, you know, you might not even notice what it is for a sec, just realize, hey, this sounds familiar. And then it's actually this, you know, string cover of a pop song. I believe the artist is a Vitamin String Quartet. We might say Vitamin String Quartet over here. And who covered their songs. And after they did these covers, their streaming numbers, as often happens with music from Netflix and others, just started to absolutely skyrocket. I read one report where it said they saw their numbers growing by over 350% based on this Bridgerton effect. And you know, that's shows not alone. Game of Thrones, Westworld, and others have used kind of similar works, and it seems to be driving this flywheel of younger people getting into listening to, you know, string covers and maybe getting them right into classical music. So what do you have a take on this kind of surge of classical covers, and why do you think this has become so popular with younger people and kind of bridging them to the classical genre?
I think it's the main thing is exposure. I think none of us are born thinking that classical music isn't for us or that heavy metal isn't for us. We're born with a pair of ears and a heart, and then we have these experiences that then shape then what music we like, depending on what we're exposed to, and crucially what we're exposed to before preconceptions of music come in. So then when the music is presented in a different setting, so in a TV show, that might be your first encounter with it, because you didn't experience it at school, or your friends didn't listen to it, or you mentioned before your family didn't listen to it. And then actually, I like that sound. I like the way that those strings sound, or you might even not know what the instrument is, but it's been put into your space. And I think that's crucially important, that we make music, we have exposure to music for young people before it gets to the point where they automatically think classical music isn't for me. So when it's in TV or it's in a film, I mean, film soundtracks, but also now gaming music is hugely seeing a boom here in
the
UK.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. So there's composers like Hilda Gustnadottir and Jessica Curry, they're writing these huge film scores, that they're like film scores, but for games. And then people are going to see them in concert and seeing an orchestra for the first time. So it's just putting it in the right spaces, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. There's a series in Toronto where you can go and listen to classical music being played live, where it's candlelight. And so you go into a sort of a candlelight place and they play classical music live, but of some of these types of pop covers as well. And another series I saw at one of the theaters here, which I think is really cool, where they actually do the film score played by live symphony orchestra while you watch the film.
Yeah.
Which is such a neat experience. And I know it's popular with, you know, millennials, it's a big date night thing for them to do, because it'll be, you know, The Godfather or Star Wars or something like that. And they can go and watch these old films and without the live classical music score.
Yeah.
So interesting.
And I think it's interesting that you mentioned the word experience, because I think that is the the thing that we need to figure out how to do as an industry is to follow through from people wanting to listen to it on a streaming platform and enjoying it through to going to the live concert experience, which is like nothing else. It's so unique and such a special environment. Of how do we get those listeners then to come and experience it in person and kind of then grow that community and the audience? So it's, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, but I think you're making an interesting point, Matt, which is that, you know, changing up the way that people, I guess, experience a concert from the maybe this what's viewed as the sort of stodgy old kind of, I go to the symphony, I sit down, we're super quiet, and you know, it is you know a very serious affair, to kind of creating something that's maybe more attractive to young people as a way
more accessible to that generation.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You know, Jess, one other thing that's kind of new, not so new, but, you know, is maybe a factor in consumption is social media. Social media kind of seems like an unlikely place to discover classical music, but apparently it is. And there's a growing number of accounts on TikTok and YouTube focused on classical music, some with tens of millions of followers. And I read about some recent TikTok challenge, which was this sort of hashtag classical music, which was tasking TikTokers to post video sharing what classical music means to them. And this generated 734 million views. Have you observed this yourself? Like, I guess you're a musician yourself. Do you use social media to reach your audience? And how important is that to connecting with younger people, you think?
It's something that I have a kind of constant dilemma about. So I have Instagram, I don't have TikTok. And just as a general, away from music, just as a general way of communicating with each other and moving our existence increasingly so online, is something I kind of have a constant kind of conversation with myself about, because I'm someone who's really driven by people and interactions with people and meeting people and being in a space. And I really appreciate the power of social media, but I think working out how it's best effective to not just be the 30 seconds of classical music or any music or whatever it is, but how we kind of keep the attention span a little bit longer so we can introduce the people to the film, the live film experience, and the kind of the follow through. But there are some amazing accounts out there and some really entertaining and educational accounts as well. But it's something I kind of feel a little bit strange about, because I think there's nothing like being in a room with a friend listening to a band or listening to a record or going to see a gig or a concert and that kind of being together through it. So it's, I don't know, but then there are communities online. It's
a, right. Yeah, it's an interesting different way of connecting with people, but I totally hear you. One other thing we've heard from others is that sometimes social media and streaming to that regard can sometimes change the art form, in that the artists recognize that they need to feed this machine, you know, which is constantly posting. So they're putting out music in little drips and drabs. Songs are getting shorter and shorter because they've realized that people's attention spans, as you're sort of talking about, is extremely low. You know, also that you don't get paid on Spotify for if someone skips in the first 30 seconds. And so music is changing to sort of put the hook in earlier, and songs are getting shorter, which are kind of things where maybe in classical music you can't play that game, because a lot of it is, you know, it's an art form that may not be conducive towards that sort of gamesmanship of the algorithm. But have you witnessed any of that happening in the classical world, about it really warping the music itself as well as people feed the social or streaming algos?
I think so, because I think albums become a little bit more uniform because people realize what works well on a streaming platform and speak to the algorithm. And then we might have 500 soft piano albums where you can hear all of the felts and the hammers of the piano, because they can go on an ASMR playlist, or they can follow that trend. And then things, I think, become slightly diluted because we can anybody can upload that album. Not anybody can make that album, but anybody can upload music to it. So there's this kind of what feeds the algorithm, but the algorithm only lasts for so long, and there'll always be a new trend, a new thing. So I do think that that kind of the artistry will prevail over the algorithm, because people still have tastes and still have emotional reactions to music. But I think one of the most interesting things is the labeling of the music. And I think streaming services, they do have kind of mood-based playlists, maybe more so even than classical rock, indie and the genre playlists. But I think we'll see an even bigger shift away from things being called classical music, because classical music isn't really a useful term, right? Because it encompasses so much. It could be a film score, it could be Beethoven, it could be Bach, it could be Caroline Shaw.
It's like almost like calling the rest of music rock or something.
Yeah,
like
just it
too
is
broad,
exactly.
A description.
Yeah. So I think mood will be the way that the streaming and algorithms head even more than they already do.
That makes a lot of sense. And I had read too that maybe one other explanation for the classical surge in listening to was a bit of the COVID effect, where people are working more from home and, you know, or want background music to sort of soothe them a little bit. And this is obviously a great choice for that. And so using it as background music, you know, to suit a certain mood, whether it's working or just chilling out in some way.
Yeah. Yeah, and some of that might be classical music, and some of it you might call another name. But at the point where I think people are kind of choosing to tap into it and use its benefits for health, finding some solace, uniting people, it's got to be a great thing to bring people together through the music as well.
Yeah, indeed. Absolutely.
And so, Jess, now is when I'm going to ask you for a music recommendation, something we can throw on our guest picks playlist. Do you have like a good, you know, something maybe for people that don't know that they like classical? Do you have something that's like a good gateway classical music?
Classical music. There's so much. I listen to a lot of Max Richter, and I think his music is a great way to kind of become more familiar with orchestral soundscapes and that kind of sound world, but it still feels very rooted in familiar music. And right. Also Bernstein. I mean, it's always a winner. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm gonna look into, I know Bernstein, but I'm going to look into the Max Richter as well and dig into that and maybe pull something from that for our guest picks playlist. And so the podcast should be easy for people to find. It's The Classical Life. And where else can our listeners, that want to follow you or your work, where would you like them to go?
My music is all on the streaming services we mentioned, on Spotify and Deezer and Napster, all those places. And live shows are also on my website as well, jessgillumsax.co.uk.
Sounds good. And we'll put a link to that in our show notes as well. And Jess, want to thank you so much for being on our show today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. Thank you.
Thanks, Jess.
You've been listening to Beat Seeker with your hosts, Matt McButter and Mike Wider. If you like the show, go to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts and hit the subscribe button. While you're there, leave us a rating and a comment and share it with your friends and colleagues. If you want to dig deeper into this content, visit beatseeker.fm. That's beatseeker.fm. Interact with us on social media at BeatSeekerPod. BeatSeeker is recorded in the Devil Lake Studios and the Tunnel Under Arundel. The show is produced by Matt McButter, Mike Wider, and Kate McCartney. Thanks for tuning in, and keep seeking.